Stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. A huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
This is the Vorpal Network.
Scene, still not exactly in focus, but boy, is it better than it was 5 minutes ago. My name is Don Riefler. This is Culture and the Paranormal. And what I'm going to talk about today is basically cultural patterns and paranormal belief, and I'll get to kind of the thesis of the talk, I suppose, here in a second. But before we get started, I am sort of officially representing the Women Thinking Free Foundation. I'm a board member of the group. We do science, critical thinking, and feminism, mostly in Chicago, but we're trying to sit down a foothold here in Indianapolis as well. And our big campaign is Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated. And so what we've been doing is we tried to get a booth here this year at Gen Con. It just didn't work out. But we have been asking, I'm going to pass this hat around for tickets. If you have your tickets for the event, please put them in the hat. That way I can turn them in. Also, if you just have pocket change, any donations we get, every little bit helps us spread information about childhood vaccination, adulthood booster shots, and we also throw booster clinics, something else we try to do here at Gen Con. But Indiana law makes it very prohibitive to throw a free booster clinic anymore. So we appreciate anything that you got, and if you don't have anything, that's cool as well. But tickets are great because then I turn them in and they go, oh, people came to this thing, maybe next year we'll let them do it again. So yes, they let me do it again after last year. More fools them. But, alright. Come on in, have a seat. He's collecting tickets and pocket change for a vaccination drive campaign called Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated.
I got some pocket change.
And I think I'll go ahead and get started then. So, like I said, my name is Don Riefler. My background, at Purdue, I have degrees in philosophy and anthropology, and this is going to air on the anthropology side of my pseudo expertise. I'm not an expert, I'm not a PhD, I'm a master's student at IUPUI in museum studies, but I do have an interesting perspective on how to look at these things from an anthropological perspective, and also on how not to get a paying job. So, these are just a couple of blurry and fortunately out of focus pictures of different cultures from around the world. And it's very easy, to recognize culture when we're looking at a culture that's not our own. Up there, we have an African tribe, and over there, if I remember correctly from when I put this together quite some time ago, that is one of the northern Eskimo or Aleutian Native American tribes. But everybody is a product of culture. We have our own culture here. We talk about American culture, but it's hard to really visualize what the culture is that we live in because we're stuck in the middle of it. We're embedded in it. That's clearly culture. But for a lot of people, in some sense, well, they've got that culture, but ours isn't really the same because it's us. But as a matter of fact, to them, it is exactly as different, and our culture is exactly as influential to us as we believe that theirs is to them. They're a product of their cultures, and we are a product of our culture, because everybody's a product of culture. It doesn't mean you don't have free will, it doesn't mean you don't get to make your own decisions, but it does mean that you grow up with a certain set of ideas and a certain worldview and a certain set of precepts and perceptions about the world because of the culture in which you are embedded. And one of those sets of precepts is the set of ideas about what is called paranormal, or what is considered paranormal in the culture where you are from. So my basic idea here is that paranormal explanations for experiences generally draw from prevailing cultural narratives, and they fill in perceived holes in understanding, which I mean if there's something that the people in the culture can't explain for whatever reason, or feel they can't explain, or don't have an explanation for yet, this is where you will find paranormal explanations for phenomena. And these phenomena are usually anomalous or extraordinary experiences that people can't quite figure out. But the upshot is that these ideas are different from culture to culture. And so if we do a broad kind of surface level cross-cultural survey, we can see that paranormal ideas here are not the same as they are over there. And thus, maybe what we're looking at is a cultural phenomenon and not necessarily something that exists in physical reality. A good example of this, just as a brief survey, is crop circles. And most people are familiar with crop circles because they really captured the cultural zeitgeist in about the mid-90s, I think was the last time crop circles were really big. And as it turns out, it was a couple of Irish dudes with a plank and a rope who started the whole thing. And then there's a crew of performance artists called Circle Makers who make these really elaborate ones. And there was an expose on TV with time-lapse video of how over the course of a night, yes, they can do that. And it's really, really cool and really awesome. But there are still people around who call themselves seriologists who believe these are aliens or, whatever. But the interesting thing about crop circles is they started off in the UK. Whoa. Yeah. Oh, jeez. I'm so sorry, everybody. It really wasn't doing this yesterday. But they started off in the UK. That's where the crop circle flat began because of the drunken Irishman with a plank and a rope who thought it would be really funny one day to go out and flatten their buddy's corn. This caught on in the Western media, thanks to our wonderful 24-hour news cycle, and pretty soon we were seeing lots of crop circles in the United States, another country that shares a common language with England, a not entirely common culture, but there are similarities here, more similar than we are to some of the other places in the world, and we also happen to have a lot of cornfields. Pretty soon thereafter, you started seeing crop circles in Australia, also English, a former colonial territory, shares a common language and a similar culture. And that's pretty much where you saw crop circles. The aliens, I guess, just wanted to land in places where everybody spoke English and happened to have a lot of corn lying. But the alternative explanation is that all these cultures where this idea of UFOs doesn't have the same kind of cultural currency, and where there's not a common language to disseminate the ideas quite as readily, just didn't catch on quite the same, and therefore the people who were hoaxing the crop circles, or would have hoaxed the crop circles in those countries had it caught on, well, it didn't catch on there because they're just different enough that it didn't make it to whatever culture they're living in. So we're going to look at two very different cultures from us, and they're very different from each other, to kind of give you an example of how at the root level, not the pop culture level, but kind of the deep cultural level, paranormal explanations can differ from place to place. The Gabusi is a culture that lives more or less, they're still around on Papua New Guinea, and I'm going to talk about them as they were in the late 70s, early 80s. Right now, they've been mostly anglicized and converted to Christianity, and they don't live in the same situation anymore, but late 70s, early 80s, they were still living in tribes and bands in the jungle. The Dobu are another tribe in the Dobu are on the island of Dobu, and I'm going to talk about them as they were in the early 19th century because things have changed very much for them in the last 100 years. So the Gabusi have an interesting idea, and that idea is that nobody ever dies of natural causes. People only die if they have been murdered. Ergo, if you didn't see somebody murder this fellow who died, it must have been a sorcerer. For the Gabusi, at least in the early 80s, death was the unexplainable, it was the anomaly, it was the hole in their understanding. When it happened and they couldn't see somebody holding the knife, they filled in that hole in their understanding with magic, with a paranormal explanation. What this led to for them were literal witch hunts and wizard hunts. You know, when Uncle Steve died and nobody stabbed him to death, we have to go find a whole bunch of evidence, and they would find evidence. They'd pick things up on the floor that they would interpret to mean this is a spell packet that the wizard mixed together that caused this to happen to Uncle Steve, and because of this signature we know it was this guy, and then they go and murder that guy, and justice has been done. The Dobu have a very different idea of the paranormal. They lived in an extreme limited good culture. They really, really believed that, and I should preface this by saying that this conception of the Dobu has been questioned more recently, but it is in a classic ethnography of the group, so I'm going to go with it anyway. But they believe that there is a severely small upper limit on resources, and they lived on a small island, so there was an upper limit on resources, but they believed it to the point that if your taro crop was not quite T-A-R-O, not T-A-R-O-T, they weren't growing fortune-telling cards. if your taro crop was smaller this year than it was last year, the only possible explanation, because there is only a maximum amount of stuff, and we always get the same amount of stuff, is that somebody else used magic to shrink your crop and grow their own. It's not just the vagaries of the soil this year, or the rains, or random chance. It is intentional. And it was somebody else who did it because they wanted something and they didn't want you to have it. So whoever had a bumper crop that year would get framed as being a sorcerer who stole everybody else's taro. And because for them, they couldn't understand why naturally things would just not even out over the entire island. Why not everybody would have the same crop? Because everything seemed like it ought to be the same. They all had more or less the same plots. They were growing the same plants, but that's more or less speculation. Their hole was differentiation in crop size, and they filled it with magic. They filled that with their own paranormal explanation. In the modern West, we fill all sorts of holes in understanding for anomalous experiences with different paranormal explanations. A thing in the woods might be Bigfoot. A light on the stairs might be the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall, a very famous ghost picture. And something you see in the sky might be an alien spacecraft. But the upshot really here, this is the last time I'll read off the slide, I think. Different cultures view different experiences as anomalous. The Dobu viewed less crops as anomalous. The Gabusi viewed death as anomalous. We view things in the sky, shapes in the woods, lights in the house as anomalous. But across cultures, they're always filled in with supernatural or paranormal explanations. So we're going to look at some more pop culture ideas here now and see how through space and time, how these different cultural narratives work to fill in the holes in the things we don't quite understand. Because that's where paranormal explanations crop up, is in these holes in understanding, in these anomalous experiences. But it works differently depending on who you are, where you are, and when you are. So sleep paralysis is going to be our first one. Now, sleep paralysis, has anybody here, do you know what sleep paralysis is, and have you experienced it? Yeah, I have had it multiple times myself, and it's a fairly harrowing experience where you wake up, you cannot move from the neck down, you're fully cognizant of what's going on around you, and oftentimes very creepy things are going on around you. Often reported during sleep paralysis are visual and auditory hallucinations. I have had both of them. A feeling of weight on the chest as if something was pressing down on top of you. And it's easily explained as a phenomenon called hypnagogia, where you wake up during REM sleep, your brain's still partially dreaming, and it hasn't turned on your voluntary nervous system yet. Your motor skills are still turned off, because if it didn't turn that off while you were dreaming, well, that's what leads to somnambulism, sleepwalking, and that kind of stuff. So most people, most of the time, it turns off while you're in REM sleep. But if it doesn't quite go to plan when you wake up, you're stuck in bed with these weird, half-dreamlike experiences, and sometimes you feel like there's a weight on your chest. I felt a presence next to my bed. I heard a guy in my roommate's bedroom listening to the Beach Boys. He didn't have any Beach Boys MP3s on his computer. I couldn't figure it out. But when you look back through early medieval history, people had these experiences. They didn't know what caused them. They didn't have neuroscience to tell them this is how the brain works. This is this hypnagogic hallucination and sleep paralysis. So their ideas at the time were there were these creatures called changelings, depending on which edition you prefer. We've got the Disney Technicolor edition and the we just read the Sandman and we really like Neil Gaiman edition. And the changelings, the fairies, the what have you, the brownies, they were the ones who were on your chest. And maybe it's because they were holding you down so the other ones could steal your child and replace it with their own child, or a bag full of sticks, or maybe it's because they were trying to rape you or something like that. In pre-Christian Europe, and even into post-Christian Europe, this was the explanation, the paranormal explanation given for this whole understanding. You move forward into Christian Europe, and you get Succubus and Incubus, the two male, the male or the female and male demons respectively, who were on your chest trying to rape you. Sometimes it was also witches who were doing that, but maybe the witches were possessed. Who knows? But it was the Christianized ideas that took over the old pagan ideas of, oh, the same thing is happening to me. I still can't explain it, but it's not the brownies anymore. Now it's somebody from hell. It's from this new system of belief, this new narrative that has permeated the culture. These days, the exact same thing happens, and people tend to report it as an alien abduction. They had the bright lights, or they heard this presence, they felt this presence, they couldn't move from the bed, they saw a creature that had a kind of look kind of like this, which incidentally, oftentimes when somebody would see a fairy or a changeling during an episode of Hypnagogia, it would also look very similar to a gray alien. There's speculation and some interesting neurological data on why that might be, but I'm not an expert on it, and it's not very solid anyway, so I'm not going to go into it. Under there is Betty and Barney Hill. Betty and Barney Hill kind of created the paradigm for the alien abduction experience when they had a period of lost time one night when they were driving home, about 2 hours of lost time. They didn't think anything of it until a few weeks later when Betty there started having very vivid, very terrifying dreams. Barney didn't think much of it still. He thought she was just having these weird dreams. She was kind of a sci-fi enthusiast, but she was having these dreams about aliens and being inside a spacecraft, and eventually she went to a hypnotherapist who found her repressed memories through hypnotherapy of having been on this spaceship where they took the gray aliens with the big eyes, except originally hers had big ears and big noses, but that changed over time and eventually became the standard gray aliens we see today. They were taken up onto the spaceship, they were probed, they were examined, they were shown star maps, and they were left back on Earth after their memory was wiped. And this is the paradigm that many, many, many alien abduction stories have had ever since this day. They kind of permeated the culture. They planted this seed in the culture that this is how an alien abduction experience has to happen. And thus, whenever somebody has a weird anomalous experience like that these days, it tends to bear a strong resemblance to Betty and Barney Hill. Now, I'm going to say this now, and I probably will say it again later. It could be that the aliens are there and they're abducting everybody in the same way. It could be that the aliens were back there in Christian times and pre-Christian times, and the aliens were interpreted as changelings and as demons. But given that we don't have any solid evidence for the aliens themselves, the simpler explanation, the Occam's razor explanation, is probably that the cultural narrative told people how to experience what it was that they couldn't explain. So next we're going to look at were-creatures. Again, I like White Wolf, what can I say? That's the new one. Newer, I suppose. It's not that new anymore. So in Western cultures, we have werewolves because we have lots of wolves around. England has wolves, and Europe has wolves, and America has wolves. And wolves are a very scary creature for us, and so we have a lot of wolves. But Native American cultures also had, they had the were-bear idea. They had skin changers of different animals, the buffalo creatures that they were familiar with. In Africa, there are were-jaguars. In certain parts of Asia, there are were-tigers. The point being that if there were were-creatures, you would expect probably a fairly even distribution across the world, but instead what we see is people who see were-creatures that are creatures of the animals they're already familiar with. You never see a were-elephant in North or South America, and you never see a werewolf in a place where nobody's seen a wolf before. And finally, the devil's footprints will give us a chance to look at. This is kind of more speculative. Is anybody familiar with the devil's footprint story from Dover, England, back in, I want to say, the 18th century? It's this creepy story. It creeped the hell out of me when I was a kid. That these little footprints, about 3 inches across, they look kind of like a hoof, walked for miles and miles and miles after a night of big snow in Dover in England, and they would walk through walls and over roofs, and then they just ended, and there was no explanation, and nobody could figure out what it was. And because they looked kind of like a hoof, at the time, it was a very religious atmosphere, and people said, clearly, this is the devil. This is the devil's cloven hoof, and he was walking through, and that's how he went through walls. That's how he walked on top of roofs. When you really break it down, there's not a whole lot of evidence that it really even happened the way the stories have been passed down to us. There was probably something there. We don't know exactly what it was. But the real point here is that had they not been in England in the 18th century, they might not have interpreted it as the devil. The devil was very present on the minds of the British folks at the time. Had this happened after a big snow in, say, ancient Greece, oh, there's the devil, they might have interpreted it as Pan, the cloven-hoofed god. And the same thing would have been there, the same lack of explanation, but because they think of Pan instead of Satan, they would have explained it completely differently and believed it just as strongly. If you live in the year 3000, you might interpret it as the moon. Now, there's also a very cool phenomenon of differing actual perceptions, not just different apprehensions and ideas about anomalous experiences, but actual, literal differences in how things are perceived across different cultures. And I'm going to use Japan and America as my example of this, and I'm going to use ghosts as a subject matter. Because in Japan, people who see ghosts never, ever see ghosts with feet. And in America, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but a lot of times, ghosts have feet. Ghosts walk around places, there are, to quote Ghostbusters, full torso vaporous apparitions, you know, or they go up and down stairs, and sometimes they float, sometimes they're orbs, but very oftentimes, ghosts do have feet in American ghost sightings. In Japanese culture, you look back through the art and the conceptions of ghosts through the history of Japan, and the traditional form of Japanese ghost never has feet. Always has robes floating down here where the feet should be, just a little bit off the ground. In America, ghosts don't always have feet. Yeah, there's Samara. She looked kind of like that old type of ghost. In America, ghosts don't always have feet, but sometimes ghosts really do have feet. Sometimes we don't think of a ghost necessarily as a spirit, but we think of it as a recording of a person that their emotional energy left on the fabric of what the hell ever, I don't know. And that person, because it was them and they had feet and legs, they're going to walk around. UFO sightings, this is a bit of pop culture here. There was a study a couple years ago, more or less a statistical survey of the frequency of UFO sightings relative to UFO consciousness in pop culture. UFO sightings spiked when Close Encounters came out, they went down. They came back up when Independence Day came out. And the X-Files, was excellent for UFO sightings because people are thinking about these things. There were also minor spikes during waxing and waning popularity of Doctor Who that were localized more to England than anywhere else. But if UFOs are capturing the popular consciousness, capturing the imagination of America and England and these places, right now, people are way more likely to report that they've seen an alien spacecraft. Could be they are seeing alien spacecrafts and they're thinking about it more because of the stuff on TV, or it could be they're thinking about it more, they see something in the sky, they don't know what it is, and instead of going, oh, I wonder if that's an airplane, they go, oh, holy crap, that's a UFO, that's an alien spacecraft, because that's where their brain is, because that's where pop culture has put them, and they're embedded in popular culture. Pop culture mythology has a whole lot of explanatory power. I've already covered Betty and Barney Hill, who created the mythology of the alien abduction, and almost all abductions from Travis Walton, The Fire in the Sky, Gentlemen, to the way it's portrayed in the X-Files and other bits of pop culture, is very heavily based on the paradigm they created. To the left here is a fellow named Kenneth Arnold, who was he kind of kicked off the first big UFO sighting flap, is what they've been calling them forever and a day. I don't know why. Flap is a big wave of UFO sightings. He kicked it off. In 1947, he was flying his private airplane around Mount Rainier, and he saw these things, these lights off in the sky in the distance that were moving very quickly between the peaks of the mountain range. And he came back and he told people about it. He described these things. He clocked them, figuring the distance between the mountains and how fast they moved. He figured they were going at a very high rate of speed. And he described the way they moved as like saucers skipping across a pond. He drew a picture of them. He said they looked like boomerangs. The news media took his quote, condensed it down, Kenneth Arnold pilot sees flying saucers. They even ran this picture oftentimes with the headline, with the story. But what captured the zeitgeist was the phrase, flying saucers. And so even though the guy who kicked off the fad saw boomerang-shaped craft and was pictured with the drawing he made of the boomerang-shaped craft, thereafter people saw saucer-shaped spacecraft because of the headline that had really caught on with everybody. the mythology was created around an idea that wasn't actually accurate to what had happened in the first place, and afterwards, what we see is a whole bunch of saucers, and relatively few boomerangs. You see those every once in a while, but they... actually, we'll cover that in a second. Boomerangs became more popular again in the 70s. Looking back in time, there was a phenomenon called the Phantom Airship. It was the UFO of the late 19th century, very early 20th century. For about 4 or 5 years, we had apparently a steampunk genius who was flying around in this thing. It was an unidentified flying object, which, remember, doesn't mean alien spacecraft. It means you don't know what it is and it's above your head. It was a UFO that people were seeing before aliens were in the popular consciousness. Really, at that point, you had some early beginnings of H.G. Wells science fiction, but not to the extent that we have today. What people thought of when they saw this was the Phantom Airship. They thought it was a dirigible. They attributed it completely to a human being. It wasn't an alien, because they weren't thinking about aliens. It must have been a rich industrialist who had the technology to build this thing and fly it around. Like it says up there, sightings even went in flaps just like UFOs. People would see it for a couple of months, then it would die down, nobody would care about it. Somebody else would see it, it would get reported, it would capture the zeitgeist, another flap of these stories. And there were even stories of people who had gone up and met the industrialist. He picked them up in the airship and flew them around, and lots of these crazy things happened, but they all bear a striking resemblance to the pattern of UFO sightings today, when UFOs are interpreted as alien spacecraft. Now, if we look at how the paradigms have shifted through the years with UFOs in popular culture, we first see the Phantom Airship, then we see the flying saucers, which were in fact supposed to be boomerang shaped. The Lubbock lights, Lubbock, Texas in the 1970s, reawakened the boomerang fad after somebody reported that particular configuration of unidentified lights in the sky. People started seeing that everywhere where they had never seen it before. Then we had the alien abductions with Betty and Barney Hill, which really shaped how these things were going to come in the future, but I've said that twice already. And then the gray aliens, which I will show you a picture here in a second of the evolution of alien aliens visually over time. It was put together by a guy named Joe Nickel. But right now, almost all aliens are gray aliens, unless you're David Icke, a really crazy conspiracy theorist who thinks they're reptilians. He thinks they're lizard men. If we look at ghosts, what we see are different conceptions in ghosts that shift over time. At first, they were full torso vaporous apparitions during the era of spirit photography. When we saw that picture of the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall, that was a very popular way that ghosts tended to look in reporting, in reports and in photographs in that point in time. Later on, getting into the 70s and the 80s, we see wisps and smoke ghosts. These days we see a lot of orbs, which you'll see underneath there, and also EVP was a thing that somebody came up with, and that captured the ghost hunting popular consciousness, and now EVP has picked up a lot. One thing that I like to point out when you're looking through the history of ghosts is that all of these are, let's see, we have high degree of detail, a middle degree of detail, and a very small degree of detail. The further you get into the present, the closer you get to now, the less detail you have in ghost photography. That also coincides with how good cameras are getting. The higher quality of the camera happens to coincide with how hard it is to get a really high detail picture of a ghost. We can't have double exposures anymore on digital cameras, and we don't tend to get full torso vaporous apparitions anymore. That's all I'm saying. So here is the slide. Jesus. Hey, Tom, could you just go or just lift it up so it's in focus a little bit? Just hold it up about and wiggle it. And now straighten it out. Lean it this way for about 5 seconds. And right, turn it back. We're doing homeopathic succession.
Yeah, do the hope. Okay.
All right, well, let's just leave it there. It's still slightly better than it was before. God, this would be great if you could actually see it. So a guy named Joe Nickel is a paranormal investigator, a scientific paranormal investigator, put this together. He's also a jack of all trades. He has degrees in English. He's a magician. He does all sorts of great stuff. He's a very, very cool, very smart guy. And he put this together looking at the different ways aliens are reported down the years.
Dates, I can read them off here.
That's fine, we don't really need dates. It's just, the point is, we have this progression here where the earliest aliens, see, were humans here. First we had small people and this guy, but there were a lot of human reportings of the people from other planets were just exactly like humans, kind of like Superman, for example, in a similar point in time. Then we had lots and lots of different kinds of aliens, big guys, Jawas, I think that's an Ewok. There's all kinds of different types of aliens all through here. This is the Betty and Barney Hill alien, the original gray aliens. Different kinds. We get down into the 80s and 90s, the era of the X-Files, and we see a convergence where we have much less diversity, and down here in the last 10 or 20 years of the graph, we have gray aliens, just gray aliens. The previous diversity of aliens, either they got bored and didn't care to come to Earth anymore, or we had enough ideas in our heads from the culture we live in that aliens are supposed to be this tall, have big gray heads, big black eyes with no pupils, split nostrils, and no lips on their mouths, three fingers, they don't wear clothes. That this is what we see now. When people see aliens, they see what they expect to see thanks to the culture in which they live. This is the culture in which they live. This is the popular culture where people are getting many of their ideas that are then being translated into paranormal experiences and explanations. It's a very, very big business right now on lots of different television channels that, in my opinion, ought to know better, or at least not be about these things. Monster Quest has jack and shit to do with history. I can't figure that one out. But the History Channel really did kind of go from being the World War II channel to the, now it's mostly the Nostradamus channel.
Yeah, it flips back and forth between the Disaster Channel.
And the Nostradamus channel. It's what are people watching this week that we can pretend is history? Yeah. Or their new slogan, history, happening every day, or whatever is that is, so they can show stuff from now and call it history.
Ice road
trip. Yeah, well. I wish that was history. But all of these guys, all the ghost hunters here, use very similar techniques. I think the most different, we have these, well, I hate doing that, sorry about that. We have Jason and Grant here from Ghost Hunters, and Shaggy and Scooby Douche from Most Haunted. Or are those the guys from Ghost Adventures? Those are the guys from Ghost Adventures, Shaggy and Scooby Douche. The guy who's like got the really big muscles and he always shows them off and he's like, there's a ghost that way. Dude, did you see the ghost? But they use very similar methodology. They have they look for EVP and they have thermal cameras and they have different thermometers and stuff like that. The Paranormal State kid here, Ryan Buell, he is a bit different. He does the EVP stuff, but he's also a lot more mystical in how he hunts for ghosts, kind of reaching back into a Ouija board kind of paradigm at 3 a.m., which is the dead time, if I remember correctly. That's according to him, that's when ghosts come out. But they do...
Because the ghosts must be lonely.
Yes.
What else can you do at 3 a.m.?
Listen to Rob Thomas. apparently. When you really kind of break down what they're doing, none of it's based on solid science and solid research. It's based on shared assumptions and this kind of mythology that grew up around the ghost hunting community, that this is what ghosts are and this is how we can find them. This is the evidence they leave behind. Well, they haven't established that ghosts exist, much less what their properties are or the evidence they leave behind, but that doesn't stop them from using the similar tools, which is then reinforced by all the other ghost hunters who use the same things. It kind of builds this culture of, oh, this is what we're doing and this is in fact scientific, despite what most legitimate scientists have to say about it. But what is important to keep in mind here is that no matter how good a science TV show is, it's not real science. And I love Mythbusters, but I don't think it's a legitimate criticism of the entertainment and educational value of the show that it's not solid science, but it's not solid science. Doesn't mean you can't learn from it. But if you're watching something on television that's purporting to be science and it's not hosted by Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's apparently doing a sequel to Cosmos, they're working on it right now, and for some reason Seth MacFarlane is producing it. I guess he's going to have like a talking animal sidekick. that's my guess. If there's not a legit scientist on there talking in his area of expertise, you want to take it with a grain of salt as far as assigning scientific traits to it. Now, we do have data. Right now, I'm saying something, I've been saying it a lot here, that pop culture influences the way people react and believe when confronted with the anomalous, extraordinary, or unknown, or unexplained, or in their minds, unexplainable. And that's all well and good to say. But until we have data, it's kind of hard to actually back it up. It's just solid speculation. Maybe it follows a valid and sound chain of logical reasoning. But we do have data, and it's a small study right now, but it's still a good leaping off point, a starting point for further studies like this. Glenn Sparks is a media researcher at Purdue, and I met him a few years ago. He talked to a group I was in about this very study. Does television news about UFOs affect viewers' UFO beliefs in experimental investigation? And basically what they did was they had people come in to the experimental area, and they showed them a news report that was neutral about the existence of UFOs, and then they showed them a more Robert Stack Unsolved Mysteries kind of, there are these aliens here, and these people have seen these aliens. They showed different groups, different newscasts. And then a couple of weeks later, they called them up and they said, hey, how would you rate your belief in the existence of alien spacecraft and visiting the Earth and various questions of that nature? And as it turns out, the people who had recently seen Robert Stack and his trench coat rated much higher in their belief in UFOs than did the people who had just seen a fairly flat, neutral news report, which is compelling data. Compelling evidence that suggests that, in fact, all speculation and anthropological hoo-ha aside, the culture we live in really does affect what we believe, and it really does affect what we think about and how we perceive and interpret these experiences. Which is to say that when you have a lot of TV shows about ghosts and UFOs and big feats and stuff that are passing themselves off as legitimate science, and a lot of people can't tell the difference between really good science and not so good science, you will end up with people who have erroneous beliefs that they formed based on this understanding they picked up that kind of permeated their brain and got into their skull there because this is the culture they live in, and more importantly, in America right now, this is the pop culture they live in. These are the ideas that surround them that allow them to make sense of the things that they see. So, I'm not going to read it. I don't want to read off the slide again. But the basic point is everything I've been saying up to now, that everybody is embedded in a cultural context, and that cultural context does not determine, it's not a deterministic argument, but it shapes and it affects your worldview and how you think about, interpret, and perceive the things around you. And if ghosts were ghosts, we would expect that all ghosts the world over would look the same, because they are what they are. They either have feet or they don't have feet. I suppose you could make the argument that there's various species of ghosts, but why would you say that? You don't know anything about ghosts in the first place. You just made that up. If were-creatures were were-creatures, you would expect that maybe one werewolf would somehow find his way down to Africa, and some were-cheetah from Africa would maybe perhaps find his way up into Europe. Especially after all the years of colonization and moving all around the globe. But instead, they're very localized, and they are the animals that people see. Which says to me that it's not so much that there is an actual material phenomenon going on outside of the heads of the people who are seeing these things. Not so much that, but more that this is the culture they live in. This is how they think about things. This is the data and the information they are given. They see a hole, and they plug that hole with the readily available information brought in from the culture that, to them, unless they really stop to think about it, is more or less invisible. Probably there aren't ghosts. Probably there aren't aliens. I can't say that for sure, but I'm pretty certain myself that it is the case, that UFOs are not visiting Earth. I should say, probably just statistically, there are aliens somewhere out there. But they're probably not coming down to Earth and abducting people and probing them and doing all of these things. Probably what's really going on is people are having experiences they can't quite figure out, and the world around them figures it out for them and allows them to have an explanation that makes them feel better, so they no longer have to say, I don't know what that was, I don't know what that creepy thing was. So that's pretty much my presentation. So thanks, everybody. Questions? We got some time. It went a lot faster than it did last year. I guess I'm more comfortable with material. We got about 15 minutes, so if you want to ask questions or just talk or whatever, yeah. And if anybody came in late and we don't have your tickets and you do have tickets, could you walk the hat around?
Yeah.
Yes, I think I saw you first.
Yeah, Elliot O'Donnell, who was writing in the 1930s, actually did write about were-cheetahs in South London.
That is excellent, and I did not know that.
Yeah, he was... not perhaps the most credible writer anyway, but I think what he did with that is he very much played on people's fears of immigration and immigrants, mm-hmm, that at mm-hmm. that time there was a small African population in South London. And he did very well at kind of manipulating and playing around that. You know, these people are here, they're very different to us, so obviously they change into cheetahs. And there is a story that these people changed into a cheetah and murdered a child in Wood in Kent.
We did a panel yesterday that was all about cryptozoology and like fake animals and mythical animals and cool real animals, and somebody brought up, well, how do you explain what would you say about the explorer books and stories from the Age of Exploration, that there were some humans who had bizarre human traits like faces on their stomachs, or they didn't have a head and stuff like that. And my answer was kind of similar to that probably what's going on is these people are different, and we are the white people, we are the colonial powers, we're going around, we're superior technologically and we're culturally superior, that's what they thought at the time. And in order to make these people even more different than they already are, and help justify, perhaps subconsciously, our subjugation of them, oh, well, they have mouths on their stomachs. Of course they're not human. I think I saw a hand over on that side as well. Yes, sir.
So I was curious, based on, you know, what you've researched and come across, have you seen any interesting or neat paranormal type references that do span across cultures that you wouldn't have expected because the communication isn't there, or...
That's a spot question. Off the top of my head, I can't, like, there are ghosts in most cultures. There's some analog for the spirit of a dead person, however you interpret that. But the exact details shift from place to place. In my experience, this doesn't mean they're not out there. It just means that I don't have a PhD.
That's the only thing that I can think of. Yeah. I guess in my head, I was working through, I'm like, well, things that would have had that shared, you know, something that was common across cultures that didn't communicate, well, that's where it became science, and we just go, no, it is there. There are pathogens that exist that we can't see, and there are.
Right. And I guess that is kind of part of the unstated point of this, is in my research, in everything I was looking into, and I came up with this idea, and I was like, okay, let's start looking into this and see how this plays out, the actual information that's out there. I didn't run across anything that was exactly the same place to place to place. At least not until you get further into modern culture now, where you do see a lot more diffusion. Like I said, the gray aliens are pretty ubiquitous all over a whole lot of the world. It's just because everybody watches American TV, I think. But I haven't run across anything further in the past that was just exactly the same. It doesn't mean it's not there, but that's kind of the point, I guess.
I know there was a few years ago something on This American Life, and I followed up with some reading on that, where a lot of the interest in spiritualism and ghost sightings in the U.S. and the U.K. in the 1800s also seemed to track with an increase in natural gas in the home. And because they were saying a lot of the things that we think of in terms of the traditional haunting, you know, the feelings of dread, the presence at the foot of the bed, you know, someone touching you, someone following you up the stairs, are all can track with natural gas poisoning.
So you're breathing just enough to make you a little bit messed up.
And it seems to be a fairly consistent set.
That's very
of hallucinations.
Cool. There's another couple of studies that do experiments with infrasound, the opposite of ultrasound, very, very low frequencies, that show if somebody puts an infrasound speaker over here on this side of the room, you're not consciously aware of it. You can't hear it and perceive it at a conscious level. But you will feel very uneasy, and some people will get inexplicably frightened and have to leave the room. They'll break out in cold sweats because the way that the infrasound is interacting with our physiology on a subconscious level makes us feel things that people often associate with ghost feelings. And so if you live close to a train track or something and the train's rumbling by far away and it's sending infrasound vibrations through the floor up into your house, it's very possible that that's in fact what you're experiencing. It's kind of a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
obviously I'm going to have to do some research on this Phantom airship because it's totally...
Oh, it's very cool. It's
but is it all post-Jules Verne, like Master of the World?
Actually, I dated that last year when I gave this presentation, and I don't remember. It's a personal failure. I can't tell you that. I want to say it is post-War of the Worlds. But... it was, if I remember correctly, and do you know the year the book came out?
I'm sorry, late.
Did you know the year the Jules Verne book was published? You mentioned
that's earlier.
Okay,
a little early.
So this, the Phantom Airship was about 5 years between 1896 and 1901.
Okay.
So probably it came after. But yeah, the Phantom Airship is just very, very, very cool. I remember reading that in a book when I was a kid, just going, oh, it's...
That's, so it seems, is it fairly benign? Then?
Yeah, it was totally benign, and like I said, it was a dude. It was a dude. Maybe he had goggles and a clockwork arm, I don't know, but he had his airship. And the thing was, like, when you see something in the sky, and it's weird, what you see is kind of maybe cigar shape, and some UFOs are reported as cigar shape, but if you turn a saucer on its side, it's shaped like a cigar, and if you look up at the sky and see a cigar in 1896, you see a dirigible, you see a blimp, because, you know, that's what they had. And it looks the same as a saucer might look now, but... You know, that detail is much the same. The details of the reports were much the same. But we didn't have aliens then. We had industrialists.
It's interesting, in the converse to what his question was, in cases where there is some like legitimate scientific reason for something to occur that affects a culture, mm-hmm. we do see parallels across cultures. Like, astronomical myth that has to do with when you plant crops or when you have cool weather coming in, you see those parallels across cultures.
Right.
When there actually is legitimate science.
Right, and yeah, and that's like he said, bacteria infect people all across the whole world, and they infect them more or less similarly, slight differences depending on genetic makeup and individual proclivities, but if you get the flu, you got the flu. All right, anybody else? All right, cool. So thanks for coming, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. I hope I wasn't super boring. We have scheduled here. We have a couple more events coming up today. We have a big 2-hour Choose Your Adventure panel, which we've done twice already. And because the audience chooses the topics, both were completely different. We had not covered the same ground at all. So even if you've been to the other two or one of the other two, you might want to come to this one 3 to 5. But we've got schedules up here that show when we're doing that. We have that, which is in Ballroom B over on that side. And then at 5 o'clock, Tom there and I will be giving a talk called Crazy Conspiracies and Cover-Ups, Secrets They Don't Want You to Know About. So if you want to learn more about David Icke...
You've been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.
That's not canon.